And we'll hear more of that during the 2 hours as during our breaks. George Duke passed away much too young, only 67 years old on Monday. One of the great performers transforming music making in our culture. Remember him with his music today. This is also, by the way, the birthday as we do our day in history, August the 7th. This is also the birthday of Roland Hassan Kirk, the great saxophonist. We'll be hearing pieces of his as well during the course of the next 2 hours. This in our day in history. One of my childhood heroes was born on this day in history. It was Ralph Bunche. He was a hero to many people in the 50s and 40s and early 60s in the African-American community. He was former chair of the Political Science Department. But what he became, he got the Nobel Peace Prize in 1950 for his work after the man before him was murdered by a right-wing Zionist gang fighting for the liberation of Palestine for Jews, killed his predecessor. He took over and negotiated peace between Palestinians and Israelis. And won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he was an amazing figure. He was born on this day in 1904. On this day, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was born, a wobbly organizer who organized workers in this country and raised a lot of hell in her time. And we're going to remember her on this day as well. This was a day in 1893 that black longshoremen struck for higher wages, better working conditions in Galveston, Texas, and started a whole union movement among African Americans, longshoremen in this country. This was the day that the Lincoln penny was issued in 1909. Those of you who have that penny in your collection might as well sell it and make some money, if you have it, that is. This was the day that Alice Coachman was born. She was the first black woman to win an Olympic gold medal in the high jump in the Summer Games in London, 1948. This was the the day that the Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, received its independence from Africa. This is the day that black and white students staged demonstrations all through Atlanta churches to integrate churches throughout Atlanta in 1960. This is the day in 1971 that Apollo 15 returned to Earth. Some other things happened this day in history that are hard to remember, but I think we have to remember and just reflect on, giving everything that we are talking about in these days with Trayvon Martin's murder and the George Zimmerman case, that the issue of race and racism has been with us since the beginning of this country. And on this day, on August the 7th, 1947, there was a young teenage girl, her name was Ruby Attie Pickford, who was abducted and raped in Meridian, Mississippi, by a well-to-do white oil man. And she was beaten and raped. She was then tied to the bumper of his car, dragged and bound through town. He dumped her, bruised, battered, pained, bones broken, in front of a home. And that was many. I learned that story. Many of us knew that story. But that story and many more came to light on this program when we interviewed Danielle McGuire, who wrote the book, The Dark End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement. An incredible book about the use of rape as a weapon against black women and the resistance around it that took place that we don't recognize, people standing up to that. So I think we remember that on this day, August 7th, in our history. We're now going to turn our attention to what's happening in Baltimore, Maryland, and housing. We have with us in the studio Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, now a part-time professor of social work and continues to cause trouble. Jessica Lewis is with us. He's housing organizer at the Right to Housing Alliance here in Baltimore. Good to have you in the studio for the first time, Jessica. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Mel Freeman. Mel Freeman is executive director of Citizens Planning and Housing Association here in Baltimore. Good to have you back in the studio.
Good morning.
CPHA. Oh, Peter Sabonis by phone, Human Right to Work with Dignity Campaign, co-director for the National Economic and Social Justice Initiative. And Peter, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here. Sorry I couldn't actually be here, but good morning.
Good morning. It's funny because I looked at my notes and noticed you weren't in the studio. Well, where's Peter? Oh, he's by phone. There's Peter. So now I have it together. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. When we did the show the other day, had a rip-roaring hour-and-a-half debate on the hearings that are taking place tonight at City Hall at 5 p.m. on Harbor Point. A room was full of six people who were debating back and forth, three on either side of the issue. And all the public, by the way, was invited to go down to that hearing tonight at 5 o'clock to hear what they're doing. There'll be a demonstration outside by people who are looking for inclusionary housing and more outside of City Hall starts at 3 p.m. This afternoon. Jeff Singer will talk a bit more about that in a bit. But one of the issues that came up was inclusionary housing. There's apparently a law in Baltimore that says new housing being built has to include housing that's moderate price and housing for all people to be included, some percentage of their housing, in the development. Am I right about this, Jeff?
Sort of.
So explain what that is.
Well, perhaps we should have Mr. Freeman say, I can explain it. Article 13, Section 2B of the Baltimore City Code is the inclusionary zoning law for Baltimore. And it says that any developments of 30 units or larger that include a major public subsidy must also set aside certain percentage of units to be, quote, affordable, unquote. And as we talk more about this, though, you'll see that it includes an enormous loophole, which is that if, in the opinion of our housing commissioner, the developer can't make enough profit by including affordable units, then that requirement is waived, and that is subject to no one's review.
So, and is it true to say, or am I exaggerating to say, that there are no major developments in Baltimore have been built with inclusionary housing? Or is that not true?
Well, to my knowledge, and I've discussed this with the personnel of the Baltimore Housing, there have been three utilizations of this law by two developers with a relatively small number of apartments. Maybe it's a dozen or a little bit more. And that's it. The largest projects have been waived because the developers in the city say they won't make sufficient profit in order to help low-income folks get housing.
And this law has been in effect for 6 years.
Yes, it has.
So let's go around the room a bit. Mel Friedman, why is it so difficult to make inclusionary housing work in the city of Baltimore?
Well, it's really perplexing. We spent a lot of time getting this legislation in place. We spent a lot of time getting extension for the legislation, and yet and still it comes up with nothing. The fund that's needed to make the developer whole is really part of the problem. Making the developer whole is not really something that I'm interested in. I'm interested in making sure that they create affordable housing for the residents of this city. It is difficult because one of the main provisions of the law is that there should be a housing board that actually has this decision-making process to discuss the do's and the don'ts and the what-have-yous as to how we can actually make a deal like this work. And that board has yet to be seated in the 6 or 7 years of this legislation in place. Now, we are concerned about this at CPHA. We have asked on several occasions to seat this board. We have been talking with the City Council President's office, who has a willingness to go ahead and make sure this board gets seated as well. We know that there are some loopholes in the law, but we know that we really aren't going to get a chance to address those if we don't get at a table and talk about them. Instead, we're leaving the housing department with just a, okay, there's no money, we don't have to do it.
Peter, your thoughts on why this is so difficult to implement in the city of Baltimore?
Well, I think it's so difficult because the law itself was tailored to serve the interests of the private market, and it's certainly part of a all of the above strategy, or that should be utilized to create affordable housing. But it's a law that really it's a win-win law essentially, and we have a lot of developers who are going to say they cannot win under this law, and we have public officials who whose values are entirely consistent with those developers. And so that's why we have waiver after waiver after waiver. I'm coming from a human rights perspective, Mark, and so I have to talk about that. It's essentially because we don't recognize what truly is, and that is housing is a human right, that because of our own existence, we need housing, we deserve housing, and yet we continue to develop policies that seem to exalt profit as a human right rather than housing as a human right. So it's really no, I don't think it's a mystery right now why this law doesn't work. The real mystery is 3 years from now, will we see a movement in this city that perhaps is beginning now with the Harbor Point issue that holds these public officials accountable and gets a new set of them in?
So Jessica Lewis, welcome to Baltimore. Welcome to the show. You're a housing organizer with the Right to Housing Alliance. So what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, I agree with what Peter says about the human rights perspective that, you know, the law doesn't have any teeth. There's no enforcement. There hasn't been a board set up. Even on the board for this inclusionary housing law, they're only requesting that one low-income person sits on the board, and the people who are most affected in need of affordable housing are low-income people who would probably have a lot to say about, you know, how this law is enforced. But, you know, the fact is that it doesn't seem to be a city priority to create affordable housing, which, you know, speaks to what I think is, you know, as Peter said, the law doing exactly what it's supposed to do, which is kind of nothing. So we don't see the affordable housing coming out of it. And, you know, with this law sort of assuming that the benefit of this is profit for someone, if you let you know, profit be the ruling motive for this, as profit, you know, goes up, more and more people are not going to be able to reach that, and that does affect the human right to housing that does and should exist for everyone. You know, as the profit margin goes up, if we leave this sort of inclusionary housing decisions to the whims of the market, people are not going to be able to reach the housing costs are going to go up more than people can reach.
I mean, has anybody crunched the numbers to say that developers like the folks who are doing Harbor Point or any other large development in this town will actually lose money, not make enough money if there's inclusionary housing? Does anybody have those numbers that can say, yes, this is true, no, this is not true? How do we define not making enough money?
The question is not making enough money. Money is made. So are we going to make 3%, 6%, 14%? Money can be made. They're not going to go broke.
Well, I don't actually have access to the developer's own financial statements. We know, except there's an exception, that's Harbor Point. We have access to their financial statements. They would make 10% without a public subsidy, 10.7% profit without a public subsidy for this large development. They say that's not enough, and the city of Baltimore agrees. Baltimore Development Corporation says that's not enough. They need 14%. BDC, Baltimore Development Corporation, cited PricewaterhouseCoopers as their source for the need for more than 10.7%. And yet our own research shows that PricewaterhouseCoopers says 6 to 10% is an outstanding profit for a real estate development. But aside from that, some more numbers. The city of Baltimore says there are 41,267 households in the city of Baltimore, low-income households that cannot currently afford their rent, and every single one of them is at risk of becoming homeless, and many of them do.
How much was that?
41,637 households in the city of Baltimore, low-income households, cannot afford their current rent, according to the city of Baltimore.
Do you know how many people we're talking about?
Yes, I do. It's 100,004. 104,092 people. 41,637 households. These folks can't afford their rent and they're at risk of homelessness. That's why we see more than 100,000 evictions filed in Baltimore City every year. Now, not 100,000 people are evicted, but the rent court is used to try to collect rent, and Jessica's program works on this every day. Just a couple more numbers, though. 41,637 households that need help. The city's plan is to help 1,500 households over a five-year period. 1,500 of the 41,000.
300 a year.
Will be assisted by the city's consolidated plan for housing. Those numbers don't add up very well. And let me give you a couple more, if you don't mind. The fair market rent in Baltimore today is $846 for an efficiency apartment. And you would need to make $16.27 an hour to afford that efficiency apartment. How many Baltimore workers make that much? Well, we do know that the harbor developments that we've been funding through pilots and TIFs and so forth are paying significantly less than that. And the latest number I saw was $24,000 a year was the average income for people working in these downtown developments. That translates into only less than two-thirds of what someone needs to make in order to afford an efficiency apartment, not to mention a two-bedroom apartment, which is $1,251 a month, and you need to be making $24 an hour. And yet, when Walmart wanted to move into Baltimore and we asked the city council to make sure they were going to pay a living wage, which wasn't even close to these numbers, the council refused.
So, and I understand that evictions are up in Park Heights. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I don't have statistics on it, but we when we pull the rent court dockets, so when we pull rent court dockets each week from district court, we see a huge amount of non-payment complaints in the Park Heights neighborhood. We see a lot of sheriff's eviction in the Park Heights neighborhood.
I've heard a number of people in Park Heights that the eviction rates were up. Boarded houses are up in Park Heights. When we ran the 5K there the other week with Chauncey Whitehead's and the for the medical group in Park Heights, and we ran that 5K. I tried to run the 5K anyway. There was nothing but, I mean, every block was boarded up houses. Often more than there were houses where people lived, and often people living in the midst of the boarded up houses. What do you want to say, Mel? No, so because we were talking earlier about this whole issue. And folks, I want you to join us here. 410-319-8888. I'd like to know what your thoughts are about housing in Baltimore. You can bring us your own stories about housing in Baltimore. You can talk to us just about your ideas about what would fix it. What should be our priorities? I mean, how do you mandate inclusionary housing? How do you enforce that takes place? And what does that mean if it does take place?
Well, hoping tonight in the hearings that come out that we're going to see the city council members that are supportive of affordable housing and that are going to come out in defense of this TIF to make sure that it does have some affordable housing involved with it. The problem is there's just so many other things going on with this TIF that just really convolutes everything. I mean, it's a really high number that we're giving away to the developer. But, you know, that number needs to come down some. And the council people that are really supportive of affordable housing are going to step up. I hope they're going to step up. I've told they're going to step up and say, this needs to be a part of this project.
One of the things, though, that have been said to me in certain emails, I'll read some of this stuff, Peter Sabonis, is that because our property taxes are so high, we have to give out TIFs for developers to develop. And that's the rub. If property taxes were lower, then maybe we could build more affordable housing and more housing without giving money away to developers.
Well, I think that that's certainly the conventional wisdom, and that's the narrative. Last week or a couple of weeks ago, Jeremy Nowak of the Federal Reserve Bank came down here and participated in a forum that Stephanie Rawlings Blake actually spoke at. That was directed towards Rust Belt cities. And he said, we need a different narrative, a growth narrative, one that speaks to downtown and universities and makes the connection to communities of poverty. The property tax issue is part and parcel of a development policy in this city that is not transparent at all. You talk about, has anybody crunched the numbers for the developer? Well, I'm sure somebody has crunched the numbers. Are they available to us? No. Has anybody really shared with us the numbers that we deal with property taxes and the developers? You know, this is the closest, Mark, you've been around a while. This is the closest we have come to learning information about profit returns on a development project. We now know that this is about getting a return of 14% as opposed to 10%. We could get more information in terms of transparency about that, but that transparency is just one element of a fair development strategy, a fair development vision that a number of us, United Workers, Unite Here, a number of community groups, are pushing, and that involves transparency. It involves community participation. It involves accountability. And basically, it all should point toward development benefiting all, displacing no one involuntarily, and development's benefits should be shared equitably and prioritize communities most in need. You know, the fact of the matter is, going from a 10% return to a 14% return is I am sure Mr. Beatty needs that, but then I look at the other returns in the city for common folks on their homes, which are underwater, their pensions, their 401ks, which have taken a beating in the last 5 years, their bank accounts, they get zero return, and I'm sure these folks would love a 10% return on an investment, and you could get 150,000 low-income folks to put up $100 and get $14 back, especially if the city's going to guarantee it. So, you know, I think the property tax issue is, it's a red herring. It's, and it's, the information is hidden from us because this whole process is not transparent, it's not accountable, and it's the mysteries of development, and we're forced to accept these what I consider are myths and legends.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888, and your thoughts on housing in Baltimore. The hearing's tonight at 5 o'clock. I'm encouraging most Baltimoreans who can fit their bodies into that place to go in to be seen so you can hear and listen what's going on. Demonstration takes place outside at 3 p.m. This could be the beginning of a different kind of movement in Baltimore. We will see. Eric in Parkville, you're on the air.
Yeah, Mark. How you doing? I always enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I thought I'd miss you coming on in the evening because I could get a full listen while I'm at work or while I'm away from the job. But anyway, my point is that I'm somewhat a newcomer to Baltimore,
uh-huh.
And I've actually heard about how much cheaper Baltimore is than D.C. But the truth of the matter is, at least in my experience, that there's just about a dime's worth of difference in terms of your rentals. I see people being evicted, you know, monthly in Parkville area. So it's not just in Park Heights. It's throughout the city. The rents are too high. And they need rent control in this city. You know, you follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Baltimore, one thing about Washington, D.C., you know, the word is that it is very expensive. Well, in the past few years, it's become very expensive. But they have rent control in a lot of those apartment places like that. They have set-asides for people who are on low and fixed incomes, i.e. senior citizens, people with disabilities and things like that,
mm-hmm.
or people are just struggling to, you know, stay above water. I don't see that in Baltimore, you know. And the other piece is that you have to pay the utilities, the gas and electric. That's another thing that puts people in the hole. So until they fix that, you know, until they get to the bottom of that, I don't know who has to do it. I've been reading, I read the papers, I listen to you a lot, your show. How is the mayor going to get 10,000 new residents when the taxes are outrageous in this city? You know, there's no rent control. And like you said, people getting evicted left and right. What is the incentive to live in Baltimore City?
Eric, thanks for the call. We'll tackle what you said when we come back from this very brief break. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Eric, thanks for your thoughts. We're going to go out here with Dookie Stick, George Duke. Keep him going.
At the bridge is on this side of the border.
Give me some of that.
Won't y'all come on over here with us? You wanna walk the water? And if you ever should see a skunk shake his rump, tell him to come on over here for some.
I need
the way I feel. 410-319-8888 is the number here. This is George Duke. We'll be remembering him all day long. Passed away on Monday. We're here with Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, Jessica Lewis, housing organizer for the Right to Housing Alliance, Mel Freeman, executive director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association, CPHA, Peter Sabonis, Human Right to Work with Dignity Program, co-director for the National Economic Social Rights Initiative. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Maureen. You're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Maureen.
Maureen Daly. I was appointed to be a member of the Inclusionary Housing Governing Board. That board was to implement the Inclusionary Housing Law, which was passed in 2007. I will say that the board has never been convened, so we have never actually been able to take any action. But it seems to me that the TIF proposed for Harbor Point is an opportunity to apply the intent of the Inclusionary Housing Law, which said that if units had more than, if there were more than 30 residential units, then they received public subsidies, that 20% of them should be at affordable rates. And all of the residential development at Harbor Point is going to be at or above market rate. So I think this is a real opportunity if the that the city council has an opportunity to structure this TIF so that it implements the intent of the Inclusionary Housing Law, which has thousands of supporters, and both in 07 and then again in 2012 when it was due to sunset, and we made sure that it continued to 2020. So I'd like to hear any response to that about inclusionary housing means economically diverse housing.
Right. So, and very quickly, Maureen, just very quickly, what have they told you about why the board has not been convened?
Well, there were originally was supposed to be a 9-member board, and then there was some sense that the board didn't fully reflect diversity of Baltimore City, so there was a proposal to increase it to a 13-member board. And that is the last I've heard. So if the additional members have been appointed, we've never been convened. It's never been clear who is supposed to do the convening. I may take that upon myself.
Well, let me know if you do. Some thoughts on what Maureen said? Mel Freeman, go ahead.
Hi, Maureen. It's Mel.
She just hung up, but
okay.
She's listening.
Yeah, Maureen's a bit – several people – eight of the nine were initially – selected and were put in place. The ninth one was, it was going back and forth. It's now been being rectified. We have supplied some names for the additional four. And as I mentioned, City Council President Jack Young is presently the one driving, and hopefully he'll come together and select the rest of them and we can get this board up and running.
410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, how are you doing this morning?
Good. Well, Bruce.
So I turned in kind of late, so I didn't catch all of it, but I caught what one, I didn't catch the name, but the person was talking about where the developers, the numbers are fudged somewhat sometimes for tax base and about oversight. So one of the main things I'm concerned with is Baltimore Development Corporation. Personally, I don't think there was proper oversight on them. They should be disbanded, or should be much better oversight of the Baltimore Development Corporation, because they're driving a lot of the inaccurate numbers, and they're driving a lot of development that isn't in the best interest of the citizens of Baltimore.
Thoughts?
The city of Baltimore needs more waterfront development, like a diabetic needs a piece of chocolate cake. It looks good. It even tastes good, but you'll regret it in the long run. It's not good for your health. It's very clear that the development strategy that Baltimore has been promoting for about 60 years doesn't work for most Baltimoreans. It works very well for a small number of Baltimoreans. Some people have made an enormous amount of money developing downtown on the waterfront. But most Baltimoreans, their data, their life expectancy, their income, their housing status is worse today than it was 60 years ago. And there's reams and reams of data to show this. The life expectancy in Sandtown, Winchester, a neighborhood close to my heart because I worked there for about 15 years, the life expectancy there is 67 years. The life expectancy in Roland Park is 84 years. That's not fair.
Mm-hmm. You were about to say something, Jessica?
Yeah, and I mean, just going off of what Jeff says, you know, we see the toll that this housing instability causes on people, the lack of affordability causes on real people. And, you know, we see the effects of these failed development policies. We see it in rent court, where we saw 150,000 cases last year. That's, you know, 150,000 times a year someone is worried about where they're going to sleep next month. Yeah. You know, people are worried about being put out. There were something like 70,000 warrants for restitution issued and over 7,000 evictions. That's 7,000 families put out on the street. And, you know, this isn't being addressed by development policy in Baltimore City. It's not being addressed by you know, clearly this inclusionary zoning law. And, you know, this development that's happening, they're not going to be put out if they're making a 10% profit instead of a 14% profit. But, you know, every year 7,000 families are going to get put out if we don't put money into affordable housing, if we don't take the insane desire to make huge amounts of profit out of housing.
Let me go back to the phones, and we'll let Peter Sabonis jump back in as we respond to the next caller at 410-319-8888. Louise, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Louise. Welcome.
I was calling because I wanted to discuss the tax issue.
Mm-hmm.
I used to live in Baltimore City, and then I moved, and then I started renting out my condo. The tax for 475-square-foot efficiency, I just got hit with a tax bill of over $3,000. Then I got hit with a special benefit district surcharge of $177 if I paid it by July 31st.
Mm.
And I got this bill, the postmark is July 12th. And if I rent out my efficiency, which at the most I could get is maybe $950, I have a $300 condo fee. And I had to pay my mortgage on it, which is about $300. And then the $3,000 tax right there takes all of that. So it's not even worth me even staying in Baltimore City. Not to mention that when you rent in Baltimore City, you pay a higher tax than if you, you know, live in Baltimore City. And then on top of that, you have to pay all kinds of other fees to register your property and everything. Like, so it's a whole lot of other fees, plus the BG&E bill. Bills are going high, you know, very high, and they're mm-hmm. going up. So it's really not even worth it. And as far as the evictions are concerned, I, you know, totally agree that it's, you know, it's not, you can't afford to live in Baltimore City, first of all. But on my end, to evict somebody, it takes a lot. And it takes a lot of money to even go through the court system. It takes months and months and months. So then you lose out. Then on my end, I lose out money, you know, on that end, you know, if I get someone who just doesn't want to pay their rent. It's not that they have economic difficulty, because my husband and I have worked with renters who've had economic difficulty. So, you know, that's all I wanted to say about that.
All right, Louis, that's a lot. Peter Sabonis,
taxes, are important, and this is an issue that is oftentimes addressed as some sort of vision or ideology about government. The fact of the matter is that incomes, earnings have stayed stagnant since the mid-70s. Real income has not gone up. There is real anger, and there should be, about a tax bite for folks whose income does not go up. And why is income not going up? Because development has failed us, because our development policies have not resulted in good jobs, in incomes that go up, in the guarantees that workers can organize, that they'll get benefits. So the fact of the matter is that this is important, and it seems the only folks who don't pay taxes in this city are the richest ones. They get the payment in lieu of taxes. They get the tax credits. I find it hard to believe, really, when I see the average sale price of Inner Harbor condos and homes, $694,000, and Guilford, $594,000, and Roland Park, and Homeland, and even in Cedar Croft, that we do not have enough money in this city to grant tax relief, to keep rec centers open, to keep fire stations open. This is all about failed development here, and what we need is a fair development vision that benefits all, that is shared equitably, prioritizes communities and needs, and that has public participation. It's open and transparent, and it meets human rights outcomes, and folks are held accountable for it. We need to lift all boats in the city and enough of this trickle down.
This is important stuff we're talking about here. I'm reminding you tonight, again, at 5 o'clock is the hearing at City Hall around Harbor Point. You can be there. It's open to the public. At 3 o'clock is a demonstration outside. We'll hear more about this. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let me read this email from Jamal, who writes in, how much in profits do you need in order for you as an organization to move forward to build these homes? I find this to be ironic when you have developers whom would purchase a vacant home for $3,000, and less than a year, the house is up for sale for over $225,000. There's no way you can convince a person that they've spent over $150,000 in repairs in order to sell this house for a quote-unquote profit. By the way, this property is located on the 1500 block of North Caroline Street. Let's say if they did spend $150,000 in repairs, and that totals $153,000 spent with a potential profit of $72,000. Even if you include monthly taxes, ground rent, insurance, utility costs as additional expenses, it's still more than 10% in profits. Jamal writes in. Any thoughts?
Sure. Louise and John raised, raised this really central issue of housing and property and its relationship to what people need. In the political economy that we currently have, a small number of people make an enormous amount of money, you know, the 1%, and a large number of people are struggling every day. And the differences have been exacerbated, particularly over the last 40 years, as Peter mentioned. While ordinary people's income has not gone up at all, the top 1%'s income has risen 300% in the last 40 years. So this unequal distribution of wealth is directly related to our problem of housing. And we won't solve one without solving the other. And finally, let me say that I think the ultimate result of all this should be our attention to the role of the public sector. And the role of the public sector shouldn't be to increase the profits in the private sector, but rather to help people with their social needs, including housing. We need more public housing, not less. We need more public housing. The United States has about 1% of all of our housing is in the public sector. In civilized countries, it's 25%. In Vienna, it's 60%. There's nothing wrong with public housing. It's a very good thing, and we need a lot more of it.
Look, you have a thought on that one, Jessica. This is where you were nodding. I thought you were having a thought.
I was certainly having a thought. I think I agree that we need more public housing, but we also need to think about different ways of thinking about property. In taking housing out of the private market, putting it in community control, which, you know, right now the public still does not have a lot of control over, you know, public property, to be honest. Considering, you know, some different options, like community land trusts are great ways to create permanently affordable housing. And it gives communities actual control over the land that they're in their neighborhoods. I also think that this profit isn't just being driven by people flipping houses over. It's being, you know, this wealth inequality is really apparent in our rental market. It's really apparent in the way that rent and district court seems to work with landlords and prioritize landlords over renters. It really just seems like it's not. It really seems like it's aimed at poor people in Baltimore. It seems like not only is there enormous wealth inequality here, but it almost seems like a lot of the city policies are punitive against people who are poor.
Let me open the phones here again at 410-319-8888. Leo, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Mark Steiner and friends, how are you?
Good, Leo Burrows. How are you?
Oh, I'm on the battlefield.
I know you are. By the way, Leo, before you even start, let me tell you that I'm going to call you later today. You need to come on this show next week to reflect on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington with me.
Praise God. God, I'm more than happy to
All
do
right,
that.
All right, well, go ahead. What are you calling about?
Let me say briefly. The eviction policy in this city is consistent with what the mayor advocated 2 years ago. The mayor said she wanted to bring in 10,000 upper-income families to this city, and she has allowed she's on track to do that. And she's doing it at the behest of the Greater Baltimore Committee and the Baltimore Development Corporation. Mark, you need to get Donald Fry, the head of Greater Baltimore Committee, on your show, and the heads of the Baltimore Development Corporation. Let's get them involved in this dialogue. There are no contractually mandated jobs in this Harbor Point proposal. They're talking about 4,000 jobs being created, which are primarily construction jobs that are temporary, that'll be over when the construction has ended. But the poor people in Perkins Homes, the public housing development, aren't guaranteed a damn thing. They're simply given promises. Don't forget the Hilton Hotel and the fact that that's a boondoggle. And initially, the mayor, who was then a city council person, voted for the Hilton Hotel, which is drowning us in red ink at this point in time. So the goal, brothers and sisters, is to eliminate poor people and the lower middle class and to gentrify Baltimore City. And to that extent, it's conspiratorial, it's deliberate, and the mayor is a flunky, as is the governor of the rich folk.
Leo, thanks, brother. Always good to have you on the air with us here, and look forward to having you on as a guest next week. But let me address some of what Leo just said here and see what your thoughts are. Let me kind of turn to Mel and Peter first on this. I mean, one of the things we talked earlier about, and I don't know enough about this to say what, you know, about this development, though. It's a beautiful development. I talked about, I'm going to go visit to see for myself, the Mount Verde Row, which is down in Park Heights, where they rehabbed an entire block and did all the fronts and the empty houses they rehabbed inside. And they're selling them for like $160,000, I think. And some people from D.C. have bought the first couple of houses, what they told me. And I want to go look at it. I mean, I think on some levels it's a beautiful idea to rehab Lower Park Heights and redo the fronts and make a neighborhood look whole. I think that's important. But one of the things it raises, when they were saying that very positively, someone else raised to me in when I was at this 5K in the neighborhood in Park Heights, saying, well, it looks beautiful, but does that mean that what you're doing is pushing us out? Does that mean that what we are developing now is Lower Park Heights to be a favorable place for people of means to move into because it's so close to the train station, because it's so close to downtown? So the Park Circle becomes an area that is developed for the middle class and upper middle class, or at least to move in as starter homes or whatever, to change the face of the neighborhood. That's why what Leo's saying, bringing people in, and where do people go who were the renters, who were living there in apartments, who maybe own a house and they can't fix it up because they have no money. I mean, therein lies part of the issue.
Well, this is the primary crux of the problem. As long as a private owner can rent his home or sell their home for whatever price they can, they're going to do that. Therefore, there's no protections of any of the renters that he previously had. If the present renter cannot afford his new rent rate, they have to go somewhere. And it's usually, as we've just discussed, on the street or to another neighborhood that is more dangerous, has less opportunity, fewer transportation options, poorer schools. And there has to be some place. We've got to figure out where to get some inclusionary housing in neighborhoods of opportunity where families have a chance to put their kids in school and go to sleep at night like the rest of us do, knowing that when we wake up in the morning, all of our stuff will still be there.
Peter,
and,
go ahead.
And Mark, the displacement issue is the very reason why folks like Jeff Singer and I have and other homeless advocates, longtime homeless advocates, always end up talking about development when we talk about housing, because essentially this is about property values, it's about increasing property values, and it's about a market that is supported by the public sector that is speculative. It's a speculative market, and all we have seen is prices go up, rents have gone up, home ownership has gone up. This is the big bite out of our budget. This is the reason that all of us struggle every day to meet our housing costs. And as you pointed out,
this new development looks good, but it does have a ripple effect, and it is not inevitable. We have, as Jessica pointed out, other models that can ensure permanently affordable housing, and they exist within the market. The Burlington Community Land Trust in Vermont is a good example of that. The Community Land Trust is a device which is hard to explain, but it does limit the return on particular properties to keep them permanently affordable. We can have nonprofit housing. We have a land bank authority that could, in the city, that could be gathering up these vacant houses, eliminating some of them, moving others to permanently affordable models like the Burlington Land Trust, like the Genesee County Land Bank does in Flint, Michigan. There are ways to do this that ensure that the residents of this city are not forsaken. And in fact, that is what Stephanie Rawlings Blake tried to say at this conference a few weeks ago here at the Fed in Baltimore. She said, everything we do is designed to retain our current residents. It's not forsaking residents. We have to attract new residents, but it's a half-baked strategy. It's half-baked if we don't have a retention strategy. Well, those are empty words. We need a retention strategy, and I think it really goes to vacant housing. If you want to do something with $107 million, turn to vacant housing. Let's have a community TIF. I can put together the numbers that will crunch appropriately, and we can have a bond issue that will raise property values in Park Heights and other places so that we can take care of some of this vacant housing and keep it permanently affordable once it's rehabbed.
Now, then that's the area you're working in, right, Jessica?
Yes, we've been working in the Park Heights neighborhood for about a year. And we, you know, a lot of our members are concerned about the raising prices, the development that's about to happen there. Mostly it's still demolition at this point. But projects like this Monteverde project are sort of scary for our members because they start to see, you know, the home purchasing prices going up, and they wonder how that's going to affect their rent. We are seeing some rents go up. People are concerned that you know, affects their bottom line of how they're able to survive. And that does manifest in more rent court evictions. And, you know, so there aren't really any stopgaps in place to keep residents there. And in fact, you know, representatives from organizations that are working on the development there have indicated that most people who live in that area currently are not going to have much opportunity to stay there or to come back. So it is, you know, it is a big problem in that neighborhood that you know, there hasn't been participation, that the members are seeing the rents go up because of development projects like this.
And I say I'm not condemning a Monteverde Row because I haven't been there. I mean, the people seem very serious. They're a nonprofit developer. They're not a for-profit developer. So I'm interested to learn more about what they're doing, and to visit those homes and see what people are saying who live on that block. Let's get one more quick call. We have like 3 or 4 minutes left in this segment. Russ, you're on the air. Welcome.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests. Mark, I wanted to very quickly go back to what your guest was saying about income and productivity, because for the first time in I don't know how long, we are seeing a situation where, don't have to get the grass or pie charts, but we're seeing a situation where productivity in this country up over 10% in the last 5 years, but incomes have stagnant to falling. It's the first time I've seen those arrows go in different directions. So I think what's happened is, as he pointed out, what you got an increase of 300% to the top 1% over 40 years. That tells us where the money's going. But what I really wanted to point out, and I'll click right here, is...
We're losing you, Russ.
Yeah, just that...
And we only have a minute left.
If you look at where Baltimore wants to go to D.C., go around 14th and T, 14th and U, where H-Rap was down there, Island Burn, Baby Burn, and look at the Starbucks and the Lexuses and the BMWs, and you'll see. Because when they redevelop, you cannot afford to move back into the neighborhood that you were in. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Russ. Well, I mean, I know as someone who lived in that area way back when the Panthers had their headquarters around the corner, It was, and you go to 14th and Unal, and it's just, and that's what some people are afraid of here. But I think that's the kind of conversation we need to have. And I think our earlier caller is saying that that what we should do is, Leo suggests we have other people on from BDC and others. We want to do that, and we're going to attempt to do that and have this conversation on the air with a lot of parties like we did Monday, talking about the Harbor Point things going on tonight. You want to make an announcement before we left here.
You're very kind. Yes, to 3:30 p.m. today, front of City Hall, there will be a demonstration about affordable housing, inclusionary housing, our economic development strategy that has failed for most Baltimoreans. 3:30 today, front of City Hall. And then secondly, September 16th, there will be a forum at the Enoch Pratt Public Library on housing, affordable housing, and the National Housing Trust Fund. Representative Elijah Cummings will be speaking. Paul Graziano, our housing commissioner, will be speaking, and I may have an opportunity to talk to both of them.
And we're doing housing shows every week leading up to that day to keep this conversation alive in our city. Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, Jessica Lewis, housing organizer at the Right to Housing Alliance, Mel Freeman, executive director of Citizens Planning and Housing Association, CPHA, Peter Sabonis, Human Right to Work with Dignity Program, and co-director for the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. Thank the four of you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we're going to take a brief break and come back. Michael Lesko will join us in the studio to remember Art Donovan. Stay with us.